Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is legendary journalist James Fallows, once a speechwriter for Jimmy Carter. Remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom at gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. In other exciting news, the documentary Carville, Winning is Everything, Stupid, is now streaming on Max. Get updates and some great behind-the-scenes content by following James on Twitter, @JamesCarville, and on his new TikTok. We hope it continues to exist for James, at least, @RealJamesCarville. You also can get text updates about what's next for Politicon and Politics War Room by signing up at Politicon.com. Tell your friends about us. Remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. And please check out the links to our sponsors, MD Hearing Aids, Magic Spoon, and Acorns. We thank you for supporting these sponsors because it helps make this podcast happen. James Carville, this week was a downer. In some ways, more of a downer even than the election results, which were depressing. Republicans have spun this line that January 6, 2021 was normal, largely a peaceful protest. Some members and hack pundits say what happened 4 years ago was really no different from Democrats objecting to elections won by Republicans. Those are total lies. In 2001, 5, 17, a handful of Democrats objected to a vote count in a certain state. It was brushed aside. No senators joined. Al Gore dismissed it when he was the losing candidate, but vice president in 2001. Instead, what we saw 4 years ago, 147 House members, 6 senators supporting not only Trump's lie that the election was stolen, but really giving some credence to the mob, the insurrectionists that stormed the Capitol, threatening to kill Mike Pence and Nancy Pelosi. You know, to this day, Trump and his enablers persist in this lie, pretend that we didn't really see what we saw. Police officers who were beaten. That's just a figment of our imagination. It's the worst whitewashing since the Lost Cause. You know, they hold tributes to Ashley Babbitt, I believe is her name, a demonstrator who was killed when she tried to break into the Capitol. I am sorry she lost her life. But Trump and his amen chorus are contemptuous of those brave Capitol police officers who tried to protect people of both parties from that mob assault. They were beaten, suffered heart attacks, strokes, needed surgery, and eventually, several died. I just want to read one thing I think I'm pronouncing this right. Aquilino Gannell, one of those officers, recalls how, I mean, people need to remember this, how he, quote, tried to protect officials, regardless of their politics, without firing my gun. Rioters beat him until he was covered with his own blood and thought he was going to die and never make it home to see his wife and son. To Sergeant Gannell, it's devastating to hear Trump say on day one, he'll pardon those insurrectionists, let 800 convicted criminals back on the street. This guy, this brave sergeant, had to leave the police force due to his injuries, but he pleads, don't let Trump get away with rewriting history. So far, he's getting away with it, James.
It's getting away with so much, you can't believe it. And you know, I don't know who to blame here, but I mean, I suspect there are a lot of different entities to blame, but the idea that this stuff doesn't break through with people is really depressing. That you saw what you saw with your own eyes. We didn't just see it. Every Republican saw it. Every American saw it. It was, you can't unsee what you saw. And now they're telling you didn't see it. I mean, I understand that people don't have trust. But, you know, well, I don't have any trust in the news media. I don't have trust in corporate America. I don't have any trust in this. Okay, you don't even trust your own eyes anymore. I mean, think about that. I mean, you saw what you saw, And then everybody decided they were going to just unsee it. And it was school kids going to the Capitol and learning about democracy. So it's beyond depressing. I wish I had something like uplifting to say about the whole thing, but I really don't. But I think that everybody is getting really distracted here. That's what I really think. And, you know, so yesterday, I got getting calls about Trump's press conference. Okay. In one press conference, he talked about annexing Greenland, Panama Canal, making Canada the 51st state, and changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico to the Gulf of America. And what is this all about? Ask yourself that the president, soon to be president of the United States, talked about annexing Greenland, the Panama Canal, making Canada into the 51st state, and changing the name of the Gulf of Mexico. I think that Trump's campaign, and if somebody did this, I'm going to give you my roadmap for fighting back. Somebody get a clip of every time in a campaign Trump telling voters, promising voters that he was going to bring food costs down and inflation down. That was what was central to his campaign. Don't kid yourself. That's how he won. He convinced enough people that he had, that inflation was low under him, and he had the secret to make it lower. All right. Be stupid or whatever. So as soon as he gets elected, he says, I really can't do that. And he knows from experience, the crazier the idea he has, the more people will cover it, the more they'll get distracted, and the more they'll talk about that, and not talk about the central case that he made to get elected president of the United States, that as soon as he got elected, he said, I really can't do anything about it. And, you know, it continues to work. And the bigger the lie, the bigger the distraction. And so he's just come to primarily understand that. And we all, and if you watch cable TV, which I do some, not that much, but I do some, I go to the sites, I go to them, and they're all about Greenland, the Panama Canal, or Canada. And no one has pointed out, hey, you just reneged on the most repeated campaign promise of this century. And one of the reasons that he gets away with it is, to some extent, we all let him get away with it. Because we don't hone in on everything is alive, but some of them were fundamental to him winning an election. No one voted for him on Greenland. They voted for him because in the back of their mind, they had some convoluted idea that he's a businessman or inflation was low under him and he'll do it again. And of course, he can do no such thing. And by the way, Albert, take a look at how the bond market is reacting to all of this, and not very favorably at all. Interest rates are going up and they're going to continue to go up. And, you know, I hate to say it, but that's what you voted for.
Yeah, it is. James, you're talking about the most important things, and I want to come back to them in just a minute. Let me just close the loop a little bit on January 6th. And I want to just say that it's bad enough that they devised this alternative narrative. Now they're saying it was Trump critics who were at fault, taking his place as one of the dumbest members of Congress, alongside Paul Gosar, Clay Higgins, the departed teen predator Matt Gaetz, is Georgia Rep. Barry Loudermark, who spent 2 years trying to discredit the January 6th comprehensive report on what happened that infamous day. And with nothing but baseless innuendos, you know what he came up with? It was all Liz Cheney's fault. She really ought to be indicted. I mean, there was an excellent rebuttal from a Democrat named Joe Morrell, who I guess is a chairman of one of those committees, who said, and this is, I don't hear this kind of language often up in the House, that Loudermilk's report was an effort to erase a tragic chapter by leveling malicious and despicable allegations against those charged with investigating the events. I am convinced that there is almost a likelihood that Trump is going to try to indict Liz Cheney and Jack Smith. It is absolutely preposterous, but that's what he does. And the one thing I would say is that Merrick Garland, who dragged his feet too much on the January 6th inquiry, it is imperative that in the next couple of days he release Jack Smith's report on Trump and January 6th. That he owes that to the public. And I'm sure Trump will try to stop it from his friendly Supreme Court. But I think it would be an outrage if that report doesn't come out. And James, I couldn't agree more with you that Greenland, Mount McKinley, the Gulf of America, they're just diversions.
And the reason it works so well, because you have a graphic. So they have, we can show the Gulf of Mexico. Oh, we can show Greenland. Oh, we can show the Panama Canal. And look at this. And then, you know, I mean, if somebody's interested in this, Walter Pincus has a great piece on the whole kind of history, you know, a thumbnail history of Greenland. It never knew it occupied, you know, front and center in American consciousness. But one of my favorites is that, so the person that Trump's man on the ground in Greenland, okay, I'm gonna get this. There's a guy named Tony Zeeb, all right? And so he was the one that Trump accentuated where he said that he wanted the United States to buy Greenland or be a part of Greenland. And Trump puts him front and center. Now, if I were going to ask you, what do you think that Mr. Zeeb's background is? A patriotic Greenlander who's very vested in real estate there, an academic who is an expert in the Arctic North and its strategic placing, or a convicted felon? Well, you already know the answer now, don't you?
James, come on, give me a hard one.
Okay. I mean, this is the guy that he has out front. It's not that Tony, I think it's Tim. Z-E-E-B. Who is the largest drug dealer in Greenland. And he is the face of the new Greenland, Donald Trump's Greenland. And goddamn it, we fall for it again. It's that old loose peanuts thing where, you know, every time you move the football. The more you get into it, the more predictable and the more depressing it actually is. Timothy Z, the man of the hour.
But James, many of your friends are people who've been involved in politics. Many of my friends are people who've been involved in journalism. Why shouldn't many of Trump's associates be fellow felons? I mean, it just seems to make sense, I think.
You know, when you were a kid, I'm sure that your mother said the same thing my mother did, you know, birds of a feather flock together. Okay, tell me who you go with, and I'll tell you who you are. Well, you know, that might have been cliche-ish, but you know what it was? It was wise. It was wise.
Yep. Criminals have
this knack for hanging out with other criminals. Okay? They just do.
Yeah.
And that's who is in this orbit. And also, so something happened on January 1st of this year that I was having a conversation with a political operative, can't tell you this person's name, but her initials are Mandy Grunwald. And she pointed out to me that on January 1st of this year, it became the law in the United States that for senior citizens, annual prescription drug costs were now capped at $2,000. Now, let me repeat that. It is now the law of the United States that if you're a senior on Medicare, your prescription drug costs are capped at $2,000. I have no idea of how many tens of millions of people have been forced into bankruptcy to keep diabetes medication going above anything else. But, you know, we all have to ask ourselves, as me, as an active Democrat, you know, been around, you as a, you know, senior journalist, how come people don't fucking know that? We got to ask us. Every fucking body knows about Greenland. When I say nobody, okay, excuse me, almost no one realizes that, what, 8 days ago, that if I did a poll question, Big Pharma never loses anything in Washington. 90% of the people would agree with it. They actually took them on and did it. And old people are not going to be bankrupt. Families are not going to be bankrupt. And it's more than just a little bit. More than just a little bit. And, you know, at some point, we got to like try to figure out why we're not getting it out there. It's not getting out there.
No, it's really not.
And I think this is just a prime example. And I don't know how you get it out there. I mean, but whatever we're doing now, I mean, so here we now, we have this, no one knows about it. Everyone, half the country thinks that January the 6th was a tourist visit. In spite of what you saw with your own eyes, Trump has reneged on his central, I mean, as central as any campaign promise could ever be. I wish that somebody who has a video vault, okay, would go through all of the times that he said he was going to get grocery prices down. It just repeat it. But that's the only way. And the only thing I can think of is just so.
Keep it up every week.
Don't do anything new. Don't do anything different. Just keep pounding it home to the point that it pounds home so much that they start complaining. That's when you're breaking through. When they say CNN or MSNBC or the whoever is just a one-trick pony, that's exactly what we want to be, a one-trick pony here, because we've got too many tricks now. But we're losing this thing, and not by a little bit. I mean, they're winning. Usually when people fight over history, it's, they say that happened 200 years ago, and some people say this. This happened a year ago, a fucking year ago.
For
whatever depressed people are, I think you have good reason.
Well, I do, too. Let me ask you about another subject that you know a great deal about, your fellow Louisianan. Some of the establishment are saying, you know, Mike Johnson really may not be that bad a speaker, having squeaked out a victory this week. What's your sense of Mike Johnson, James?
Mike Johnson gets elected speaker, third ballot. Okay. And Hakeem gives some very vanilla, appropriate, kind of standard shit. Mike Johnson goes to the well of the House and says that he is reciting a prayer that Thomas Jefferson gave. And it's very eloquent, and it's very uplifting. And when you hear it, you say to yourself, well, that's, you know, kind of gosh, kind of religious, but who could actually disagree with this? And there's only two problems with this. One is somewhat minor, and that is Thomas Jefferson never said any such thing. There's a thing called the Thomas Jefferson Foundation or something like that, a historical society. Said there's absolutely no record that Thomas Jefferson ever said that. Okay, so sometimes politicians describe things to make them look good. I mean, that's an obvious lie, but we're accustomed to them misquoting stuff in history. It's actually so much worse than that, you have no idea. It is not, and the whole speech was about how Thomas Jefferson said that, you know, God and civil government, you know, were one and the same, and we owe them obedience. Somebody asked Thomas Jefferson, I think it was like to declare a national day of prayer. And his response was, you got to be shitting me. Do any such thing. He was a separation of church and state absolutist to ways that you couldn't believe how absolute he was. And so it's not, again, you have people lie. Okay, I understand that. And they exaggerate things and say we created this many jobs, or, you know, the country was founded as a Christian nation, and it's standard shit that people say that goes in one ear and out the other. This was beyond that. It just wasn't a lie. It was a stunning lie. It would be like saying Martin Luther King was a segregationist. It's that level. Mm-hmm. It's that level. And that's how big a liar he is. But the question is, maybe he really believes that. He might be that stupid. He just might. That's a real possibility. That he actually believes that Thomas Jefferson said that.
Hey, James, that was his worst lie of the week, worst offense. But didn't he also blame that horrendous incident in New Orleans on the border when, in fact, the guy was a American citizen, a Texan, an Army veteran?
Well, he did. But you know, why it's a minor lie, just 14 dead people. And it has nothing to do with the fact. Again, my only question about Mike Johnson is, okay, he's lying. We all know that. It's evident. Does he really know he's lying? Does he really think Thomas Jefferson said that? Does he really think that this 9-year Army veteran who was an American citizen that lived in Houston is really came across illegally at the border? I don't know if that son of a bitch is not so stupid that he actually believes
Which would be worse, James, that he believes it or he's just lying? Tough call.
I think that he... So, I'll tell you a story. I know you can't compare anything to Hitler, okay? Having said that, I'm sorry, the period of 1933 to 1945 actually existed. So there was this huge... And you know how British scholars, historians, about pissy and self-righteous self. Mm-hmm. There were two great Hitlerian scholars. One was Sir Trevor Roper, yep, and the other was Sir Alan Bullock. And they had this intense argument, and I think I'm right, is Sir Alan Bullock said that Hitler was kind of a fraud. He really didn't believe this shit, but he saw electoral opportunity in it. And he was very skillful orator. And he had, you know, Lenny would ever write these films, and he had Goebbels, and he was able to leverage this into political power. And Sir Trevor Roper said, no, he was actually believed all of this, that he at his core was a fervent anti-Semite. He really believed it. And at the end of the day, Sir Alan Bullock made an apology to Sir Trevor Roper, and he said, I've been wrong, you're right. Hitler actually believed it. So you ask yourself, what is worse, to have somebody say something just for political gain that's untrue, stupid, or to have him actually believe it? I actually think that he actually believes it is somehow or another even more damning than just making shit up. But I don't know. It's a good philosophical question.
Yeah, I think you're right. I really do.
You know, that he just, he, if you wired him up and said, do you really think Thomas Jefferson said this? He said, yes.
Yeah.
And they all get it from this guy called David Barton, who is the most read historian in the United States today, who is about as close to a total fraud as you can get. There are more people that read David Barton and read James McPherson and John Wilentz put together. All right? And history is just another thing to lie about.
Right, right.
It's just become like anything else.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really fucking amazing, man.
Well, we're going to have a lot to cover this year, James Carville. James, Jim Fallows is one of America's truly gifted journalists and public intellectuals. He was a speechwriter for President Carter and has reflected on the 39th president's extraordinary life. Jim, in a moving tribute that I watched on the CBS Sunday Morning, which is probably my second favorite show after my wife's, you said that Carter came in with magic and he went out with magic. You said it better than I just did, but talk about it.
Well, thanks so much, Al and James. And you all knew Jimmy Carter over the years, starting when he was beginning his run. And since most of the American public was not anywhere close to being alive when Jimmy Carter was president, when he won 76 or lost in a landslide to Ronald Reagan in 1980, people think of him only as this grandfatherly figure who's, you know, killing guinea worms and getting the Nobel Prize and doing these things around the world, and have no idea of how comparatively young and how absolutely exciting he was when he came onto the scene in 1976 and went within just a year, as you all know, from basically 1% name recognition to being sworn in as president. I think it was because the kinds of excitement and connecting with the nerve of the time, the spirit of the time, the hopes of the time, that we associate Democrats with Barack Obama or Republicans might with Ronald Reagan, Jimmy Carter really had in the 1976 campaign. He was a white man from the South who had grown up among black children who were his playmates. He was somebody who, a governor of Georgia, who put the portrait of Martin Luther King inside the Georgia governor's mansion or the Georgia Capitol, the Georgia State House. He was Hunter S. Thompson wrote a wonderful ode to him in Rolling Stone about his Law Day speech 2 years before he was president. He was graduate of the Naval Academy, a submarine officer who also called the Vietnam War a racist war. He was somebody who said after Richard Nixon's time that America should be better and rise to its ideals. So there was a kind of excitement to him. And you two would know this better than I, but I think it's still the case that his approval rating in his first 6 months was the highest of any president, you know, since then, you know, higher than Obama, higher than Reagan, higher than Clinton. I believe that's the case. Does that ring true to you all?
It rings true to me. People forget how disciplined he was, how tough-minded he was. He did, as you have written, came from obscurity to the White House like no one else. But you also wrote about something that is special to me, and that's the softball games in Plains, Georgia, where when he was down there, Carter, the super competitive Jimmy Carter, campaign staff would play against the press, except Carter insisted the Secret Service, those muscular, athletic guys, be on his team, so he won every damn time, especially to me because it was on the Plains, Georgia softball field where I met this attractive second baseman for the press named Judy Woodruff. So Plains, Georgia softball has – but it did. He was a very competitive, tough guy.
It was competitive. He was disciplined also. Yes, and it's not because there are these images that stay in the public mind of Jimmy Carter and the rabbit, the killer rabbit, when he was in his canoe, and Jimmy Carter having a hard time during a 10K race. I think people forget that he was actually a very talented athlete. I used to play tennis with him. I was, in my time, a good tennis player. I was sort of the ringer on the White House team. He was good at that. He was a good softball pitcher, as you call, even without his ringers. He was a good runner. So discipline extended in many ways. I'll say one other thing about him, if I could, to filibuster. I think it's remarkable. We know of people who've made their big changes in life. For example, George W. Bush, before and after his time of becoming sober, and other people who've had changes. I think that Jimmy Carter was exactly the same person at every stage of his life. And there are times when that circumstances matched his talents and times when not so much. But I think that he had these 44 years after office to make that clear.
He sure did. You also have written that he was easier to admire sometimes than to work for. He could be very demanding.
Yes. I was talking with somebody a day or two ago, and they were talking about Jimmy Carter's habit of autographing books, which he'd do in sort of a speed reading way of doing it as quickly as possible. I have a lot of his autographed materials, I replied to this guy. It's mainly on speech drafts with notations like "very poor," or "must be better," "must be funnier," you know, "try harder," et cetera. Do I have to put up with this? So he was, he was quite, I think he was in the mode of his mentor and in many ways model, Admiral Hyman Rickover, of why not the best, of that you need to be always asking more of yourself. So I think everybody who knew of Jimmy Carter respected him. He was an easier person to respect, admire, and emulate than to sort of be a chum with or an employee of.
Yeah. You know, the substantive agenda was much bigger than we thought at the time. I mean, Camp David, the most important Middle East peace pact ever. He wouldn't take no from an answer from Begin or Sadat. They had to make peace or they'd never get out of Camp David. And the Panama Canal treaties, which avoided, you know, unrest in that region. And maybe his most significant appointment was Paul Volcker to head the Federal Reserve, whose successful policies may have cost Jimmy Carter re-election.
Oh, I agree entirely on those points. And just to follow up on two of them, one about Volcker, that I have heard and read that Volcker warned him, warned Carter before appointing him, don't do this unless you're serious about it. As you all recall, inflation was just out of control then. When we got the double digit mortgage rates were 15% or whatever. The first mortgage I got on the house where I'm now speaking to you in DC was 15 or 16%. So Volcker said, only do this if you're serious. And Carter really took a hit for the country in appointing Volcker. It probably was one of several things that sunk his campaign, but it was a step against inflation. There's controversy about whether Carter was, you know, too conservative in doing that, but it was brave. The other, the Panama Canal Treaty. I was in Panama as it happened last month, and it's, you know, the two things that are generally forgotten. Number one, the negotiations for that treaty started under Richard Nixon. And the reason Nixon started them was that the military was saying it would be impossible to defend this asset if it were still this colonial presence. So Nixon began them. He then was overtaken by other events. Then Ford was doing it. The other thing is that Ronald Reagan ran against Gerald Ford in 1976 against the Panama sellout. And that was one of Reagan's big talking points. Ford and Carter continued this, and I think it was a really important thing that Carter did, getting 68 votes in the Senate.
And I give great credit to Howard Baker, too, who was the Senate leader who was going to run for president. And James Carville.
So, Jim, you know, I'm into communications, and there are things that we all know that we don't know. One of the things that people used to say is Bobby Jindal is the father of school reform in Louisiana. There's no such thing. It was Kathleen Blanco and Leslie Jacobs. Right? People would say that Ronald Reagan was the author of deregulation in the military buildup, which is total bullshit. Jimmy Carter was, correct me if I'm wrong, was the person that deregulated trucking, deregulated the airlines, and started the military buildup that became so famous during the 80s. Why do we keep losing these narratives?
To start at the end, if I had a good answer to your question, the world would be different of why this happened. But you're certainly right, and you can think of analogies in our current political moment, obviously, as you all have. But Carter was really hell on wheels about deregulation, airline deregulation. I worked with Alfred Kahn, then of Cornell, and sort of setting up the airline deregulation. He correctly foresaw that would lower fares, as it did. He didn't sort of imagine all the other things that would come with deregulated airlines, including the concentration, trucking deregulation, and deregulating brewing. Anytime you have a craft beer, you have Jimmy Carter to thank because he made that legal. And the buildup, yes, after the Soviet Union invasion of Afghanistan, late 79, early 1980, Carter began the buildup, which then Reagan continued as a spend-up. But yes, Jimmy Carter, like other presidents more recently we can think of, started things that then whose benefit is redounding to others.
So, General, I'm going to turn back to you, but I've got you on here, and I know we're here to talk about President Carter, but I can't let you go because I travel a lot. Can you give us a 90-second explanation of what you think happened to Boeing, or they've been unjustly accused of? But this is like the standard American industrial giant that we all took pride in. And
yes, like thanks for asking that. And I think of two great industrial titans of the U.S., Boeing and GE. you know, founded by Thomas Edison, as having gone through the same tragic arc, which is being converted from manufacturing companies and technology companies to financial companies. When Boeing moved its headquarters from Seattle, where it had a proud machinist, technologist, designer, pilot, unionized base, to Chicago to become mainly a finance company, and the accountants and the financiers took control rather than the engineers, that was the beginning of a really tragic turn for Boeing. And I think you can see that in General Electric. So when it was a manufacturing titan, it was a manufacturing titan. Let us hope it can recover.
Do you see any evidence that they're trying to return to their coaches, engineers first, finance mechanics second?
I haven't followed it closely enough to have on-the-scene reporting in the last couple of years. I used to live in Seattle, so I saw them then. I used to fly my plane out of Boeing Field there right in downtown Seattle, my propeller plane. And I think that the FAA is properly taking Boeing under more cautious scrutiny. And I guess we're just going to have to watch the business pages to see if the people who are in the next wave of leadership at Boeing are from this now very sort of decimated and discouraged engineer cadre there. But this is, as both of you have written and explained, this is part of the story of America over the last generation that needs to be corrected.
Yeah, no, I mean, I remember, if it ain't Boeing, I ain't going. I used to I don't know about this Airbus flying, fly by wire, or, you know, there's just some new shit going on here now. It's not the same, but you know, I really, Jim, appreciate you taking time to talk about President Carter, and we just love drawing on your wisdom.
But James, there's a problem having Jim or Deb Fallows on. They know so damn much. It's hard to know where to zero. You were a Harvard guy, a Yankee. How'd you get along with those old Southern boys, Hamilton Jordan and Jody Powell?
So I'm quick to say that I grew up in San Bernardino County, California, now represented by Pete Aguilar. And in my high school football league, there was a young, you know, many generations later, was a young quarterback named Jaden Daniels, is from San Bernardino, California. So he is my homeland guy. I'm a proud Californian, and we'd been living in Texas, actually, when I was and James, you'll appreciate this. I was working for young state senator Lloyd Doggett in the Texas State Senate then, when I joined the Carter campaign in 1976. I was working for Texas Monthly. So I was presenting myself as a guy from the West Coast, what was then the Republican base, who had been in Texas. So I came straight from our house in Austin to Atlanta, Georgia, and then down to Plains in 1976. But yes, I was not a Southerner.
So who was a more prickly boss, Lloyd Doggett or Jimmy Carter?
Talk about your impossible questions.
I said, I worked for Lloyd.
Yes. They are.
God, man, our history.
And James, they were equally frugal. I'll put it that way.
Frugal is the word for
it. Jim, with that, you know, incredible celebration, it's Thursday at the National Cathedral. Carter has gotten just a wonderful send off. I have to think some of it, is the contrast between the man who said, I will never lie, and was not one who celebrated, you know, in the riches of wealth versus what we have coming in. He's going to give an inaugural address in about 10 days. What tone do you look for?
So there's the tone I look for aspirationally, or the tone I expect we'll have in the real world.
Yeah, we better go with the latter.
So it's hard to think of a public performance by Donald Trump that has not had as its central theme grievance and resentment. That was the theme of his first inaugural address. That I'm having to use the words first inaugural address make me sort of stop dumbfounded. But it's been grievance. So I assume that I don't know that there's anybody around him who can steer him to something other than grievance for this presentation. We saw it yesterday in the Capitol. Both Mike Johnson and Senator Toone of South Dakota, no allies of the Democrats, as we know. We know all the things that where I would disagree with both of them. they found ways to take the high road about Jimmy Carter personally and about his example. I do not believe that Donald Trump has that in him. I'll say also one thing that you all, I think, would both recall. The first words that Jimmy Carter spoke, instance after being sworn in as president, were, "I would like to thank my predecessor for all he has done to heal our land." He was talking about Gerald Ford. He was talking about the very controversial Nixon pardon, both controversial then and now. That pardon had actually helped Carter in the campaign, as you all recall. It was one of many weights on Ford. But Carter took the step of thanking Ford with his very first words as president. I do not expect something like that next week.
Yeah. James, you want to wrap this up?
I just can't thank you enough, Jim. And I don't think that getting more profound with the stories you told about Carter. And I think your expectation, unfortunately, is going to be fulfilled. And it's just going to be some grievance.
Of course, James, you know, when he was claiming California, he left out Harvard. But that's okay.
Is that the Inland Empire?
Yeah. Yeah, the Inland Empire is where I'm from. And the term of art, of course, is a school in the Boston area.
that's what you told Jody.
Jane Daniels has revived for Washington, D.C. sports, so let's give him credit.
Yes, yeah, so connecting the Inland Empire to D.C.
There you go.
Best to Deb, and Happy New Year to you. And we're going to have you.
Thank you so much,
man. We're going to have you back this year because there's no better guest. Thank you.
None. Thank you.
So, Alan James, great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
All right, James, now for the outrage of the week. You know, only a few years ago, Jeff Bezos was celebrated not just for his extraordinary success in creating Amazon, but as a really good citizen and steward as the owner of the Washington Post, one of America's two or three most important newspapers, especially in these times. Now we read he's more interested in currying favor with Donald Trump. I don't know the facts, but some of the most talented journalists in America are leaving one of the great newspapers in America. That's disconcerting. But my outrage, perhaps related, is that Amazon's Prime Video is exclusively licensed for an upcoming documentary on Melania Trump. It's being directed by a man named Brett Ratner, with a rather sordid past. Ratner hasn't worked in Hollywood since 2017, when after six women accused him of sexual misconduct, Warner Brothers gave him his walking papers. This wasn't the first time that Ratner faced those kind of charges. Now, Bezos can say, hey, you know, directing a film for Amazon's Prime Video is way below my pay grade. You know, not if it's about the president's wife. And of course, with the Trumps, it's always about money. So how much is Melania getting for this? And why was a man like Ratner chosen by Amazon to direct it? Like many in our business, I have admired Bezos' leadership at the helm of the Washington Post. Those admirations are wearing very thin, James.
So, 40 million, this is something I'm going to claim some expertise in, the subject of documentaries, okay? Because I've been the subject of two, and I've been the subject of a recent one. And I will flat out tell you right now that this one is not as going to be as good as Matt Turnhauer's Carville winning is everything.
Speech. That's a safe prediction, James.
That's it, yeah. You can produce a world-class documentary for $2 million. I know it. You couldn't spend $40 million on a documentary if you tried 10 times harder to do it. So where's the money going? Well, we know where the money is going. And to Bezos, who's worth, I don't know, $400 billion or something, this is all chump change. It's just another way to, like, you know, Disney cost them $15 million. Bezos richer than Disney, so he's paying $40 million. It's breathtaking. There's no documentary that's ever been made that's had even a budget of $5 million. And, you know, somebody, I mean, they're going to look into it and they'll write it, but what the fuck, you know, he's worth $500 million. $1 billion. It's so, how is the Post going to be able to cover this? I don't know. I think David Shipley's sitting in a corner under his desk, all right, being slapped around by Bezos. I mean, what's happening is right in front of your fucking eyes, right there, they're paying $40 million. And I don't know, somebody better look into this, but they could make a documentary on the history of the universe and couldn't spend $40 million.
Oh,
so much. Every time, you know, the thing about it, Albert, is every time you think it's bad, yeah, it gets worse.
The river in Louisiana.
What did John McCain said? Right. Yeah, the river, the Chaffalaya River. Yeah. Not any of those, yeah. You know, it gets dark, and then it gets really dark.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's true.
You're right.
Well, I think we shared an outrage. Is that right, James?
I think we did. I think we did. I just hope that somebody picks us up and ask them what the $40 million budget is. How can you spend that?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Matt traveled it all around the country, paid for archival tape. What he told me was that little clip of You're My Sunshine, Jimmy Davis, they'd pay $7,000 for that.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you have to pay for Still and All. They come in at like $2 million. Promotion is everything. I mean, it is utterly, you couldn't spend I don't think you could spend $10 million on a documentary. I really don't.
It's amazing.
Stunning. It's just breathtaking.
Hey, now, James, for our listener questions. We're off to a start in 2025. It's as good as they were in 2024, and I will say from around the globe. But we'll start off in Milledgeville, Georgia, with Dr. Kevin. This is something you know something about. He'd like to know any insights or stories to share the legacy of longtime Georgia Politico, who you once worked for, Zell Miller.
Oh, God. Zell held elective office in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, I guess. Obviously, he was elected mayor of Young Harris, which is a mountain hamlet right on the North Carolina border. He had a career that used to be known as kind of Zigzag Zell. And it became a kind of an affectionate term, but he was the one that ended up being successful. Understood that the Confederate flag wouldn't go on the Georgia flag, and he didn't win right away. But eventually, I think Governor Barnes did that. He probably educated more Georgians than anybody with the Hope Scholarship. That was funded by the Georgia State Lottery. And Georgia was the first state under Zell Miller that basically made higher education free for, you know, moderately well-performing students. I mean, it's a legacy that, you know, be hard to beat at any time, any place. And like anybody had a long career in politics, there's probably a couple of fish you'd like to throw back in, but he's a man of tremendous accomplishment. He never really made a lot of money. He went back and he lived in Young Harris with he and his wife Shirley and stayed very active in the college up there that he went to, I gave the commencement speech there not long before Zell died. I was glad I was able to do that. And of all the people that I worked for, it probably was closest to him in terms of being a friend. And we had a somewhat of a falling out when he voted for the Bush tax cuts, but were able to make amends. I have very, very fond memories of it.
Good. Well, Dr. Kevin, I think you got a lot there. Andrew in Jacksonville, Florida says he's surveying the land of potential 2028 Democratic nominees. Everybody is, Andrew. It's too early. But anyway, he said, why not someone such as Mark Cuban? What are the potential upsides and downsides to a non-politician such as Cuban? The answer is it's all downside. There have been two non-politicians elected president in the last 100 years. One was Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was the supreme Allied commander in World War II. Not a bad credential. And the other was Donald Trump, who may be the worst president in the history of America. You're not going to pick someone who's never been involved in surgery if you want to have, you know, your knee operated on or your brain operated on. And you're not going to pick a football coach who doesn't know anything about football. I don't want to pick a politician to lead the country who's never been, doesn't know much about politics.
So right now, this is, and you want kind of bad news, and let's just pile it on. The image of the Democratic Party is at an all-time low. Democratic turnout in 2024 was not good. There's a great piece by Michael Potthards, who's a friend of the show, who's been on there. Trump didn't really do any better than he did in 2020. Is Democrats did worse. Mm-hmm. And the truth of the matter is, I have great respect and admiration for Secretary Clinton, for President Biden, even a good deal for Vice President Harris. But we have not had an inspirational presidential candidate since Obama ran for re-election. And that's what most people do. The image of the party is one of being urban, old, out of touch, govern. And I don't think that Mark Cuban could win. I know him not well, but okay. I mean, we certainly would recognize each other and have a friendly conversation. But I tell you, if guys like that run, I don't think he would win. But if he was out and you had him and you had Wes Moore and you had Josh and Mitch and Andy and, you know, Gretchen, whatever, you name it. And boy, the more really articulate, different thinking, energetic people that we can get to run for president, the kind of better it is.
James, you may have answered the next question from Nick, who wanted to know who you thought would be a leader in the Democratic Party to voicing a revitalized populist message.
Let him run. That's not for me to decide. That's for people to get out and run for president. I think we ought to start early. We should have like a midterm convention in 2026. The one thing that I know, and I've been literally evangelical on this, I preach it till I'm blue in the face. The current talent level in the Democratic Party is the highest I've ever seen in any party anywhere in the history of the United States. And the image of the Democratic Party has never been any crappier than it is right now. Let's get this talent out there, all right? Let's get it where people can see it. And then when Democrats see it, they're going to decide. And again, there's a lot of great people that are in this forest of presidential timber. Man, there's some giant redwoods out there. And again, if a guy like Mark Cuban wants to get in, I'm kind of all for it. The more, you know, the more people say, well, geez, look at those people. They actually have energy. They can string a sentence together. They all don't come from Manhattan or Beverly Hills. They actually, you know, have done things or governing things. They've been successful in politics, successful in business. I'm all for it. Let's get these goddamn thoroughbreds out and running on a track.
Let's go, guys, Nick in Billings, Montana wants to know, what are the chances that a little bit of Senate pushback will remind Trump that RFK's usefulness has an expired shelf life? Nick, I think you're onto something. I think right now Trump is enamored with RFK. It's, you know, attracts Democrats. It still does some. The name still is magical in some places. You know, this Bobby Kennedy really is flaky. He's got not only flaky ideas, got a few good ones, but a lot more flaky ones. And he's going to create trouble. And he's undisciplined. He was hired out in Vail to be a do something big with the Vail Valley Foundation, I believe. And they had to get rid of him because he just didn't know what he was doing. And I don't know he'll be confirmed. But if he is, I think there are going to be days where Donald Trump says, why in the hell did I do this?
Let me give a shout out to Senator Bill Cassidy, Republican Louisiana.
Yep.
I think that Senator Cassidy is going to have a hard time in the Republican primary, but that's hardly fresh news to anybody. But he actually had the courage, and he's an MD, and he actually had the courage to say recently that Kennedy's wrong on vaccinations. And I'm working with a potential Hollywood superb documentary filmmaker on maybe going out and doing a documentary on vaccinations. You got to understand, the most significant public health advance, not even close in the history of the world, are, well, vaccinations. I can't tell you how many, and I want to get into this in this documentary, how many people are alive today that wouldn't be if we didn't have vaccinations. This is not a controversial thing. This is like so good for the public good, it's unimaginable. And it's of all of the kind of misinformation that's gotten out in this country, the one that's the most painful, I think, is this vaccine skepticism. I used to have pediatricians like come to my class and tell these students, you don't get your children vaccinated, you're really stupid. And you ought to hear the stories some of these people give, having to talk to these parents and giving these children, when I say life-saving, I mean like life-saving at a level you cannot imagine. I really can.
My father was a pediatrician, James, and the same story.
Yeah,
would lecture his patients. You get those kids vaccinated, whether it's mumps, measles, polio. Just do it and do it right now.
And back then, people probably had a little more faith. Look at like the polio vaccine. Oh. I mean, you and I were the generation. Our parents were scared to death. They wouldn't let us go out and play.
Right, right.
And then Dr. Salk, I guess he'd discover a vaccine. I don't know what the right word is. And they asked him if he would patent. And he said, well, that would be like patenting sunshine. By the way, Dr. Salk was from Pittsburgh. But then people like your dad would be completely befuddled if he had a patient come in that wouldn't take the polio vaccine.
Yeah.
And now it's more and more. It's not that it's just kind of insane that people think that January the 6th was a tourist visit. Of course, it is insane, but that's, you're limiting the amount of damage, pretty much to not very many people. This whole vaccine skepticism is going to kill people and a lot of people.
Right.
A lot. There's no greater public health initiative ever than vaccines, not even close.
Well, I want to join you in praising Senator Bill Cassidy. He's a great contrast to the other senator you have, a buffoon, even though a well-educated buffoon named John Kennedy. But Bill Cassidy is a really admirable conservative.
He don't back off, and he just, at least, to come out and say that.
Yep.
And, of course, he'll probably nominate Clay Higgins. Arguably, I'd like to have a debate, resolve. Clay Higgins is the dumbest son of a bitch in America. I think I could argue that in affirmatively pretty well.
There's competition, but I think you have a good case. Yeah. Jake in Langley, Washington says, as we Democrats reflect on our recent loss, I hear every explanation except the one that feels most obvious, the overwhelming influence of right-wing propaganda. Does our message even matter when they control the messengers?
So I'll tell you about next week's guest, because it was going to be this week's guest. Was a guy named, I think, Brian Taylor Cohen, who is a kind of expert, and I think he's a pretty smart guy, and he really kind of understands how people get their information. So withhold an answer till we talk to Brian next week and see how we can better communicate, because we're not doing a very good job. I mean, we just got to, accept the fact that there's been a massive failure. What did the guy say in Cool Hand Luke? What we have here is a failure to communicate. We have a massive one. And, you know, what I think this program is about, and what we're trying to do, is not argue whether or not there was a failure, because there was a failure, but to find out why it happened, what can we do to see that failure of this level doesn't happen again. It was a failure of misinformation in the election. It was a failure of disinformation, vaccines. It was a failure of misinformation about anything, January the 6th, anything you can imagine. But we have a communications problem. And let me assure people listening to this program that Al Hunt and James Carville are dedicated to find out why this happened and what can we do to try to fix this problem and make it get better, because shitty information is running this country.
Yes, it is. John in Chicago says the government of France is in disarray. Great Britain is broke. Government of Germany collapsed. Canadian government is crumbling. The United States has a lame duck president who will hand over the government to the guy who attempted a coup and mostly despised throughout the West. Has liberal democracy ever been this beaten up? And James, the answer is yeah, in the 1930s, it was in as bad shape. I just hope it doesn't take a war to get us out of it this time.
You know, maybe, but the scary thing about now compared to the 1930s, we in a world of 4% unemployment. Think about that. Western Europe is a relatively prosperous place. The United States is a prosperous place. And if we have, well, you had that craziness in the early 30s, but, you know, inflation in Germany was, I don't know, 68%. The unemployment rate was 28%. All right, so you could say, well, as an excuse, there were just desperate people looking for a desperate person in desperate times. Okay, they'll buy that, but I can't laugh in your face if you make that argument. There's nothing desperate about these times. Maybe incomes need to get better, and maybe, you know, drug companies charge too much, and there's a corporate, the government of billionaires, and there's a lot of things to be pissed off. But boy, the kind of reaction that we have now would. It's bad enough that we're having it now, but, you know, one day we're going to have 8% unemployment, and I don't want to think of what that's going to bring. Yeah. I really don't. If this is where we are in 4.
That's all I can say is you're right. Final question is from Richard in New England. Richard, we're going to ask this, but if you want to be asked again, New England is 6 states. You got to tell us where you're from in New England. But he asked a good question, James, and it's to you. Is Susie Wiles the saving grace to control Trump?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, there's evidence by the fact that you had the press conference yesterday. I don't know Susie Wiles, but you know, she's obviously, they call her the ice queen and respected. You know, I don't think Susie Wiles wants to annex Greenland or Canada or any of this other inside. There's no controlling this guy. There's no adults in the room. There's none of that. And we got to quit, not you and I, but there's no expectation that this thing is going to be anything other than a massive disaster. It's just, man, I hate to say it, but we're going to be right.
You're right.
No doubt about it. It's just what it is. Get over it.
Okay. They are good questions. Please keep them coming in. If we didn't get to yours this week, we will work on it for next week. There are so many, and you make us think. Thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. As always, send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Now, following this episode, we'd appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, MD Hearing Aids, Magic Spoon, and Acorns, in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them, because when you do, you help make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And check out our Substack at politicswarroom.com. James and I are constantly adding new content, so go take a look. You also can find other shows you might enjoy on the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. Now remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review, and we will be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.